Okay, this is the first of the so-called Director's Luncheon, which we shall be doing more or less every available Monday. This we regard as an important institution of the ITP because it's the one time we all come together and try to explain to each other what we're doing in language that would be accessible. And that's not only good for the other groups and the people who aren't working in a given field, but actually for the people who have to do that. It's very somewhat demanding to do it well, and the level of these lunches can be quite excellent, and have been in the past, and hopefully we'll continue that tradition in the future. The way we're going to begin is have two talks from the Gravity program this today and 2 weeks from today. 1 week from today is a holiday, and then two talks from the Black Holes Astrophysics program. And then we typically hear from other groups at the ITP as to what they're doing and try to tell you guys something about condensed matter physics, which might have overlap areas of interest with some of your programs. For example, today's talk is on critical phenomena in black hole physics. That was a joke.
Any case, members of the community and are heavily encouraged to attend these talks.
Today we got a very good turnout, and hopefully that will continue. The talks are called Blackboard. Another name for the seminar is a Blackboard Luncheon, because we encourage people to give informal Blackboard talks where they don't just give their latest seminar all prepared on transparencies.
1,700 transparencies put through at a second per transparency.
The idea here is to have a few of the conceptual ideas presented in a way that would be understandable to everyone. And to try to use the Blackboard, slowing down the pace of it. So we're going to start with a talk by Chuck Tuick from Texas, who is a participant in the Gravity Group, and is going to tell us about black hole critical theory.
And who's going to grossly violate the Blackboard rule. I'm sorry. I'll try not to go too fast. I'll try to keep this fairly introductory. And, of course, if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about the subject of black hole critical phenomena. And right away, I'd like to apologize to the condensed matter theorists, because we've largely appropriated terminology and ideas from statistical mechanical critical phenomena. There's really no evidence that there's a strong connection between what I'm going to talk to you and about today and what you're familiar with in terms of stat-met critical phenomena, but there's some intriguing parallels. And I'm going to start by discussing the numerical experiments, the simulations, the phenomenology of critical collapse. Mainly because that's the way I came about this, and I think it gives you an idea of what's going on from a physical point of view. And then I'll talk a little bit about the theory, how we now understand, at least to a certain extent, what's going on in terms of self-similarity and some perturbation theory, and talk briefly about some extensions and conclude with what we hope to do in the future, including some work I hope to work on here. I should mention at the onset, there are several review articles in this field already. Karsten Gunlach has put together an excellent review that's been published now in this relatively new journal, and Patrick Brady, who's in the audience and has done a lot of work in this field as well, and a student, have a nice summary that's going to go into the Marcel Grossman proceedings And there's a write-up, essentially, of this talk, if you will, for the GR-15 proceedings and a briefer review by Bizon. So if you're interested in any additional information, you can seek that there. So I'm going to just jump into a model problem for gravitational collapse. So there's sort of three aspects to this problem. There's a physical description, and largely to keep the model, you know, tractable computationally, we're going to restrict our attention to spherical symmetry. So I'm going to be talking for a little while about the spherically symmetric general relativistic collapse of a massless scalar field. Okay, so this is a field that basically has no counterpart in the real universe, but gives us a model which has radiation content and gives us the key features that we want out of a model for black hole formation, as I'll discuss. But the physical picture you should keep in your mind is imploding and exploding shells of radiation. We'll discuss this in a little bit more detail. Mathematically, this problem reduces the single wave equation, the hyperbolic partial differential equation for our scalar field, which is just a function of radius and time. And then there's a couple of additional equations which enter just as ODEs in this case that constrain the gravitational field. So in terms of general relativistic models, and it's an extremely simple set of equations of motion, nonetheless, it's turned out the nature of the critical phenomenon mean that in order to do a proper job of the simulation, you have to use relatively sophisticated numerical techniques. I won't get into this in any detail, but the use of this adaptive mesh refinement algorithm of Berger and Olliger was really instrumental in getting the results I'll be showing you today. Okay. So there's a fundamental nonlinearity in this problem that you can view as a form of competition. The scalar field's kinetic energy, and there's nothing else in this model but the scalar field's kinetic energy, curves space-time, if you will, and that space-time curvature then back reacts on the scalar field, affects its propagation. And there's black hole formation in this model. You can form a black hole when, roughly speaking, the gravitational self-interaction of the scalar field becomes sufficiently strong. But it's important to realize that there's nothing else in this model apart from Einstein gravity in a single scalar field.
What was the first paper on that by Einstein and his representative when he tried to prove that there's no black hole?
I'm not aware of that paper.
Collapsing stars, in order to prove that you can never achieve the what he called the shortest singularity.
But probably, was that a scalar field or was it some kind of a dust or fluid? I mean, the history of gravitational collapse goes back a long way.
All kinds of circular orbits.
Yeah, with
shells collapse.
Well, I mean, what I'm talking about, the history of gravitational collapse and the study, numerical study, goes back a long way. I don't know. This is purely for convenience. As far as we know, the phenomena I'm going to be talking about, and we can talk about this later on, are completely generic. Every model of gravitational collapse that has been studied so far has shown this type of behavior.
Something I always wondered is that spherical in the case of a gravitational field, spherical symmetry seems like a very bad.
No, actually, it's a very good place to start if you want to keep the problem computationally computationally tractable. No, but okay. So let's say that we want to reduce. No, but you can get strong field interactions, and at the same time, the space-time remains asymptotically flat. So in terms of modeling physical gravitational collapse of the one space one time theories you can look at, spherical symmetry is clearly the most physically realistic. Plane symmetry and cylindrical symmetry are much more idealized in that sense. Mm-hmm. And as I'll get to, people have studied departures from spherical symmetry and also axisymmetric collapse of gravitational radiation, and again, these same phenomena are seen. Okay, so just to go through a few of the details of this model, first start at the flat space-time formalism, because this is a set of equations of motion that you can all solve, and a lot of you will be familiar with. I work in spherical symmetry, again, so there's no dependence on the angular coordinates. And I choose a specific, well, I choose the usual metric, flat space-time metric, in spherical polar coordinates. It has this form. The scalar field equation of motion, and not the complete dynamics in this model, then, is just Dellenberg and phi is zero, and you can rewrite that as an ordinary wave equation for the quantity r times phi. Okay, so r times phi just satisfies an ordinary wave equation, and of course that has a general solution, which is just incoming and outgoing waves, or imploding and exploding shells of radiation. So schematically, at least, r times phi is just some ingoing function plus some outgoing function. And then, in order to describe the dynamics, we can specify initial data, and it's convenient to specify the initial data in terms of an ingoing profile, f of r, and an outgoing profile, g of r, and then the complete solution at the initial time, r times phi, is just the sum of those profiles, and you have to set the time derivative. So the time derivative of r times phi is just f prime minus g prime, and I typically set the outgoing part to be zero, so I'm just concerned with these initially imploding shells of radiation.
Is it important that these are actually zero?
No. No. But that's the basic dynamical content of this theory, or waves.
But
yes.
It can be done with particles.
It can certainly be done with particles. Okay, so this is a diagram, surface plot, of what an evolution of the scalar field looks like then. Here's the initial data surface. So I've put in some Gaussian pulse, and then as time goes on, the scalar field implodes, and because I'm plotting phi here, the potential grows basically like 1 over r, goes through the origin, implodes to the origin, and emerges, and the only thing that's sort of slightly non-obvious is that there's a change in sign of the pulse. The pulse comes out inverted. All of this you can figure out analytically. I've just put this into a code and generated a plot, a surface plot. So here again, the pulse comes in, implodes to the origin, and disperses. And the natural place for this energy, the scalar field's energy, to end up is out at null infinity or arbitrarily large distances. Now, to couple this field to gravity is relatively simple. I choose a specific coordinate system, which you can think of as a generalization of Schwarzschild coordinates. So my radial coordinate r still measures proper surface area. So if I think of an r equals constant 2 sphere, it's got a proper surface area 4 pi r squared. And I keep the metric diagonal, just like the Schwarzschild metric is diagonal. And so I have to introduce these two functions, a squared and alpha squared, functions of radius and time. And as I've said, this radial coordinate has an immediate geometric interpretation. The time coordinate t doesn't have a natural geometric interpretation, but there's a reparametrization, or a specific parametrization, or a specific way of labeling the t equals constant surfaces, which does have somewhat of an invariant interpretation, and that's if we relabel the surfaces with uppercase T, so that they measure proper time for a central observer, for an observer who's stationary at r equals zero. I then introduce auxiliary scalar field variables, which are essentially the derivatives of the scalar field, the spatial and the temporal derivatives, purely so I can write the equations of motion in first order form. But because this field is massless, it's also important to realize that there's nothing, the scalar field, the value of the phi itself has no intrinsic meaning. You can always add an arbitrary constant. All the action in this theory is in the derivatives of the scalar field. So these are the fundamental dynamic variables, if you will, and these are the things that are analogous to the E and B fields for electromagnetism. Then the equations of motion are these two first order and time partial differential equations. They're the equivalent of the Dellenberg, and these two ordinary differential equations, which constrain the geometric variables at any given time. So for those of you who know the nomenclature, this is the Hamiltonian constraint, and this is the slicing condition, which follows from the demand that the metric be diagonal. Now, these equations of motion are invariant under these trivial rescalings, which you can view as a change of units. There's no intrinsic scale in this theory. So if I tell you there's some dynamics here happening on a scale of a kilometer, then you can just rescale everything, you know, down to your favorite units, same dynamics happening on a scale of centimeters, and change the time coordinate accordingly. And it then becomes useful to discuss the dynamics in terms of variables which are at least form invariant under those transformations, even though I won't talk about these variables much today. And essentially what you do is you take those auxiliary variables that I've defined previously and multiply by R, and then you get variables which are form invariant under those transformations. More importantly, the total mass of the spacetime I can then write as an integral over this quantity dm dr, where this m is also a function of radius and time, and it's defined by the identification where this metric function a squared is written as 1 minus 2m over r all minus 1, which makes it, you know, completely analogous to the Schwarzschild line element. Then that you can show that dm dr is the square of these amplitudes x squared and y squared. And this total mass, then, gravitating mass of spacetime, is a conserved quantity. Now, this coordinate system shares with the usual Schwarzschild coordinates the property that it can't penetrate apparent horizons, and so by and large, it will not penetrate the interior black holes. However, in simulations, black hole formation is very clearly signaled by the fact that the quantity 2m over r will asymptote to 1. For some specific radius, which is the radius of the black hole, from which you can immediately read off the mass of the black hole. And so I'll show a picture, a couple of pictures now. Again, surface plots of this mass function. I've changed the viewpoint now, so the origin is over here. So this is a weak field evolution. You'll notice out here the mass is constant, but at some non-zero value. This is the imploding wave here, and this is the exploding wave. It has flat spacetime in the interior as it's imploding, has flat spacetime in the interior as it's exploding. The bottom picture shows black hole formation. So again, the initial part, the implosion, looks very much like it did for the weak field case. But now, not all the mass escapes. What happens is the black hole forms, and the scalar field, which doesn't fall into the black hole, evacuates this region on a time scale set by the size of the pulse. So it's important to notice that the scalar field doesn't linger around here. The black hole forms, and if we went into a different coordinate system, we could actually see the development of an event horizon. But the black hole forms and settles down to a Schwarzschild black hole on the exterior on a time scale given by the scale of the black hole itself. Pardon me?
What is the difference between the two cases?
Okay, the difference between the two cases is the strength of the initial data, and this is what I'll get to in a slide or two.
There's some backscatter?
There's definitely some backscatter, but the backscatter is always dynamically negligible. So, from a physical point of view, these critical phenomena, I believe that the crucial aspect of the physics here is that there's competition in the system. And you can understand this competition by asking a simple question: where can the energy and the space-time end up? So for a massless field, or for a massive field with sufficient initial kinetic energy, there's a natural tendency for the matter energy to disperse to arbitrarily large distances. And that's exactly what's going to happen in the weak field limit for the massive scalar field. You can't confine the matter energy. It has to propagate to larger and larger distances. So that tries to push the energy up to infinity. On the other hand, you have gravitational potential energy, which in this case is solely self-induced with coupling to the gravitational field and the scalar field. And if that coupling is strong enough, then you can trap some of the energy inside a black hole, and then it's localized. And so there's this competition, and you can play off these two effects and look at the threshold of black hole formation. And so another name for this critical phenomenon, black hole physics, would be the threshold of black hole formation. This is what we're interested in. We consider parameterized families of collapse solutions. So I have this apparatus, if you will, that has a single parameter, a single knob, P. And that parameter, P, is controlling the degree of self-gravitation in the evolution. And essentially, you can set the degree of self-gravitation at the initial time by changing the amplitude, if you will, of the scalar waves. Now, all I demand of this apparatus, and you could go home and build yourself such an apparatus, put it on a single parameter, is that the family interpolate between flat spacetimes on one hand and spacetimes which contain black holes on the other hand. So if I turn my parameter value all the way down to very low values, I recover the flat spacetime limit, propagation, free propagation of the scalar waves, and no black hole forms. If I crank it all the way up, I want there to be black holes, and eventually, if I crank it up high enough, essentially I'll trap all the energy in the scalar field in a black hole. But apart from that, the claim is you can choose whatever you want as initial data, as long as you have a family which interpolates, a one-parameter family which interpolates in that fashion.
I have a question here. Suppose we don't talk about waves and really talk about particles or dust or whatever. Can you really have initial conditions, purely radial, that don't form a black hole?
Yes, as long as there's pressure. Now, if there's, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, without pressure, it seems to me obvious that
if you have dust, then you always form an event horizon.
And the wave problem just has...
So always has pressure. Yes. Yeah. So, by definition, the phenomena in this near... Well, sorry. What you're going to find then, if you construct one of these apparatus, is that there will generically be a critical value at which you first see black hole formation. So there's this threshold of black hole formation. And by definition, this phenomena in the near critical regime is what we mean by the critical phenomena. So a key question, which Dimitri Christodoulou posed to me many years ago, is what is the behavior of the black hole mass at the black hole threshold for one of these interpolating families? And clearly there seems to be two possibilities. If I plot the fraction of the total mass of the system which ends up in a black hole, then either as I tune the parameter value across the threshold, so the threshold is here, either the black hole which appears, the first appears, has a finite mass, or the black hole which first appears has infinitesimal mass. And we now know of both types of phenomena in these two, in these tuning experiments, and I've called them type 1 and type 2, purely analogy to first and second order phase transitions in STAT-MEC, where I'm now viewing the mass of the black hole as an order parameter. But this is the key question.
But not convincing, not differentiable.
But not differentiable.
What happens to your critical phenomenon when you produce a scale by, say, giving the scale mass?
Again, this depends on the initial conditions. But the basic idea is if the initial data is in what you'd call the ultra-relativistic or scale-free regime where the kinetic energy is dominant, mm-hmm. that you recover the massless limit naturally.
Sure, but if you don't?
Then you'll tend to get a type 1 type of transition. And you can actually have a transition then between the two types of behavior.
I see. So it's a mass parameter then.
Okay. Well, it's actually the momenta parameter then, if you will. Not so much the mass, but just how much momenta there is in the initial data.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but you can get a type 1 without a mass?
Yes. With the Yang-Mills field, for example. Hmm. I'll show you some, if I have time, show you that. So, at the threshold of black hole formation then, again, we take these interpolating families, we look for critical points where black hole formation just occurs, and we find that the phenomenology in the critical regime is analogous to statistical mechanical critical phenomena where the mass of the black hole is playing the role of an order parameter. The key point is no matter how you originally parameterized your initial data, in order to see what's happening in solution space, you're not going to want this single linear dial. You're going to want to have an infinite set of verniers so that you can tune arbitrarily closely to the critical point. And you find that you have essentially exponential sensitivity to the initial conditions in terms of the features you see in your solution as you approach the critical point. So typically then initial data for the scalar field, again, if I consider a family of Gaussians, here's some typical profiles, then these profiles, low amplitude profiles, are all subcritical. These profiles here are supercritical. The absolute height isn't really so important as the fact that the derivatives here and here are getting larger by making the amplitude higher. And somewhere in here is this critical point at which black hole formation first sets in.
Critical, but always type 2.
Always type 2 in this model. Mm-hmm. And in the early days when I was looking at this, I went to some lengths to try to make sure that I chose suitably generic initial data families. So this is some; these are some examples of different types of initial data that I've looked at. There's a Gaussian here, so here's the profile, and there's a plot of DMDR in dotted lines. Here's a Kenck profile. This is something like a Planckian. And because it becomes difficult to sort of to choose arbitrary profiles using analytic functions or closed form functions, this shape was essentially drawn by hand. So I'm not sure exactly what you'd call that one. Okay, so I think I'll show some video now. I'll try to swing this around. I guess it depends what you identify. Well, it's the mass that we're viewing as the order parameter.
So, you know, type 2, there's a length scale that goes to infinity?
Or? Well, you can view it as a region that gets correlated, but people really haven't pushed the analogy much. It's essentially just whether or not there's a mass gap. Right, so these sequences give you an idea of what goes on with the scalar collapse. So again, they show various evolutions where what's being tuned is this parameter, this overall amplitude factor in front of a Gaussian. So P is my control parameter. And I've chosen P in this case. Well, I'll get to that in a sec. First thing I want to show you is what's happening as I vary P. So I'll just show you the initial profile of the scalar field, color mapped with its gradient, which is where the energy is. And these plots are all going to look the same way. I've made a surface of revolution. So this is just showing you what's happening as I vary the amplitude parameter. And every time I vary the amplitude parameter, I have to generate an entirely different evolution to see what's going to happen. So I've normalized the parameters so that P is equal to exactly 1 at criticality. And the first evolution is for an extremely weak, essentially linear propagation of the scalar field. So what you'll see is the scalar field itself, again color mapped with the gradient, which is where the energy is concentrated. So you see the scalar field implodes, grows like 1 over R, and then emerges inverted and disperses to infinity. Again, it's a completely soluble problem, completely linear. You can write down the exact solution. I'll show the same thing again. And it just propagates out to infinity. So the quantity which obeys the simple one-dimensional wave equation is just the radius times phi. So I'll show you that, color mapped with M over R. So you see that that amplitude remains constant. There's a little bit of interesting, if you will, dynamics at the center when the ingoing outgoing solutions superimpose. And again, the field all propagates to infinity. So now this is a subcritical evolution. The parameter value is now 0.018. This gives you a little bit of an idea of the type of nonlinearity, the type of effects that we see in the subcritical collapse. Everything happens in the trailing edge of the waveform. And one thing that you'll see, there's an overshoot here, and then there's this little bit of an extra ring that gets picked up. don't expect you to pick out too many of the details. I'll show the mass function versus radius, and you see there's two steps in the mass function on the ingoing pulse, but then it picks up this additional little lip, and that's the first indication of the, or early indication of the nonlinear behavior. Okay, now I go supercritical about the same distance of parameter space, and already at that point I've got a black hole which contains about 50% of the total mass of the spacetime. So I'm showing here again the mass versus the radius, color map of 2m over r, which is 1, and there's a black hole here, so the black color is where there would be a black hole if we could penetrate it. You can't really see what's going on in there because the scale is so small, so from now on I'll plot things in logarithmic coordinates, which essentially blows the center out to infinity. But the important thing to realize, to notice again, is that the scalar field evacuates from this region on a time scale which is set by that scale, the scale of the black hole. And so quite unambiguously a black hole forms, and you can read off the mass. This is just the scalar field itself. The coordinate singularity is developing here, so these, you get very bad behavior in your numerical functions. Now, this is a near-critical solution where I've tuned the parameter value to about part in 10 to the 15th. The interesting thing is you can fully resolve these solutions. You're really limited by floating point precision. And what you see now, the scalar field being plotted in logarithmic coordinates, is these series of oscillations. And the time coordinate you see here is also zooming in. I'm essentially freezing time. It's a logarithmic time coordinate. So those oscillations are happening on shorter and shorter time scales and shorter spatial scales. I go to the other side of criticality. You'll see at the early times, the evolution looks identical to the previous case. But in the last echo, the scalar field decides that it's going to form a black hole, and you get a very small black hole forming in the center.
Do your coordinates go inside?
They can't go in a black hole. Well, no, it's not. It's like the Schwarzschild. It's asymptotic to the Schwarzschild surface, so it's staying outside the horizon. This is, if you will, proper time of a central observer, but it can be related to the proper time of an observer at infinity. For the subcritical calculations, there's absolutely no problem. There, apparent horizons don't form, there's no black holes, so you get a global view of the space-time. And these calculations have been repeated in other coordinate systems, and it's clear that the phenomena are independent of coordinates. But the key feature, the key dynamical feature of that near-critical solution is this self-similarity. It's a discrete self-similarity whereby the dynamics plays itself out on this recurring scale. So there's a parameter that enters, I'll talk about in a second, which relates which radius and which radii and which times the various echoes occur at. So I can summarize what's been seen now in this type 2 critical phenomena, generic features. By definition, there's arbitrarily small black holes possible. So we can play this game. You tell me exactly how small a black hole you want relative to the size of your initial data, and I can tell you exactly how closely you have to tune to criticality in order to get a black hole of that mass. So an immediate corollary of that is by sufficiently fine-tuning the initial data, you get regions of space-time with arbitrarily high curvature, and those regions of space-time are visible by observers at infinity. And the precisely critical solutions then contain naked singularities, albeit extremely unstable. These solutions are unstable by construction because we have these two distinct states we're balancing off against one another. Then, interestingly enough, you find, if you look at the black hole mass, you find power law scaling. So the mass of the black hole goes like some constant, which is dependent on the family of initial data, times P minus P star, where P is this arbitrary parameter, however you want to parameterize your initial data, to this power gamma, where gamma is universal in the sense that it does not depend on the particular initial data family. It only depends on the particular choice of matter model.
Go back one
goes like that. The radius of the black hole goes like that. Yeah, the radius of the black hole that forms goes like that. The curvature goes like 1 over the mass squared. We see the scaling behavior of this critical solution then. We either see discrete self-similarity, which has also been called scale periodicity, or I just call it echoing because it really is like getting these echoes of the solution air criticality. You see that in scalar wave and gravitational wave collapse and also in Yang-Mills collapse. There's also continuous self-similarity, which is a lot more familiar to people, and we also have seen that in multiple scalar systems and in perfect fluid systems. Yes, it's exact. No, it's exact.
You mean numerically exact?
No. Well, yes, numerically exact.
Is numerically exact what you can establish numerically?
Well, then we get into this discussion of what you mean by numerical. I mean, it's finite precision analysis. All this work has to be done. There's no closed form black hole threshold solution known. But there are...
But properties can be established without having solution.
Well, not here they can't. Well, not yet, as I'll show you. But
many of us are pretty convinced that it's truly exact.
Right. You can...
By the data, or by what?
By a combination of the really high-precision numerical work and a bunch of analytic things which don't really address the whole problem, but address parts of it. There's still an open question of mathematics. There's a good theorist waiting to be proven there.
Well, that's a good question, where exactly it comes from, particularly because we have models that have transitions, if you will, between the discrete and the continuous self-similarity as a function of model parameters. So there's a lot of richness in these models.
Mm-hmm. Are there papers on that addresses these issues?
Yep. Definitely. In fact, that review by Gundlach is an excellent place to start. So, in a little more detail then, the discrete self-similarity I formulated as a conjecture, which, as Doug pointed out, it seems, all the evidence seems that the conjecture is true, that the precisely critical solution has a property that if you consider any scaling variable, such as the scalar field itself, M over R, dm dr, that asymptotically you have z star of rho plus or minus n delta, tau plus or minus n delta is z star of rho and tau, where rho is log of the radial coordinate, this aerial coordinate, and tau is log of t naught star minus t naught, and this t naught star is the accumulation point of all these echoes. So you have a geometric series of echoes here. The evolution for precisely critical space-time ends at a specific final finite proper time, and that then plays the analog of the origin of the temporal coordinate system. So if you redefine these time coordinate to be log of t naught star minus t naught, then that's the scaling relationship there, where this delta is an exponent or a pure number that comes out of the calculation, which for the scalar field has a value of 3.44, which means the scalar, the dynamics repeats itself on scales of about 1/31st. And the mass scaling for the scalar field has a gamma of about 0.37. And this is typical of the evidence you have for the discrete self-similarity in one of these full-blown solutions of the partial differential equations.
So delta is a critical exponent.
Yes. Yeah, or anomalous exponent.
You might expect a bunch of critical exponents, but here you only have one.
Well, you have the delta, and then you have a gamma. And the gamma is understood. The delta isn't understood yet.
Gamma.
So gamma is a mass scaling exponent, and that's understood in terms from perturbation theory.
Independent of these things on space-time dimensionality, though.
David, what was you studied?
Let's see. Kurt Cutler and I looked at that a little bit, and John Stewart also looked at that. So you can look at a spherically symmetric scalar field in n dimensions instead of four dimensions, and what you find is the same sort of scaling off with, you know, with somewhat different gamma and somewhat similar delta. So it's the same phenomenon, but different numbers.
Is there any pattern to the numerical dependence? Or is it just
no. Maybe
what happens when d goes to 2?
Oh, well, then it doesn't exist. I mean, you know, it's just a Yeah, I mean, we only looked in dimension, you know, for 4 and higher.
What about D equal infinity?
Well, it's kind of difficult to do it in a dimensional.
No, no, but you can extrapolate.
You can extrapolate.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we found sort of a few numbers, but couldn't determine that.
In any case, here's a couple of profiles extracted from a single simulation where all I've done is rescale the later one. So the later one happens on a smaller scale, and I've just shifted it in logarithmic space, and the profiles overlay very well, and this can be done in all phases of the collapse. And as a partial answer to your question, Karsten Gundlach starts from the discretely self-similar ansatz. He sticks that into the equations of motion, and he gets left with an infinite series of ODEs that he has to solve. And they seem to self-consistently close, and he gets he basically does a Fourier analysis and has a rapidly converging series for the exactly discretely self-similar space term. Yeah. This is what you typically find for the black hole mass scaling. Well, here's my parameter, my initial data, which has a bunch of adjustable parameters and overall amplitude factor, the center of the Gaussian, the width of the Gaussian, I can generalize the power away from 2. And there's actually 3 data sets plotted here, one for the amplitude, one for the width, and one for the power. And you see in all cases you get a pretty good linear relationship. It's now known that there's actually, for the scale of the field, an overall oscillation on this, which has a period which can be computed from the other known exponents, but whose amplitude, again, will be something that depends on the specific model which is being studied. And I should point out that this is an extremely well-studied model now from the point of view of critical phenomena. There's been a number of rather complete studies. This study was somewhat superficial, but they got the mass scaling. But then David did a nice piece of work reproducing essentially all the results I've talked about, as did Halliday and Stewart, and more recently Hodden Pran, who observed this fine structure on the scaling law, this wiggle, which had been independently predicted by Gundlach. Okay, I just want to point out that these results have been extended and have been observed in many other models. Perhaps the most important one in terms of the physics, there's a work by Abrahams and Evans in axisymmetric pure gravitational wave collapse, and so that dates back to 94. And the data aren't as clean here, but this is evidence of echoing in a particular metric function, and they can see about 2 or 3 echoes. The echoing exponent in this case is much smaller. Things tend to echo on a scale of about 2, which is very fortuitous because these results take a lot more computational power. They also see scaling of the black hole mass. And interestingly, the exponent that's observed is about 0.36. And so for a while, it kind of looked like there might be true universality across matter models. Well, okay, against models of gravitational collapse. And a very important piece of work followed shortly later, Chuck Evans and a graduate student of his investigated the collapse of a perfect fluid for a specific equation of state, the radiation equation of state. And Chuck had the idea that there should be an exactly self-similar solution in this model, and so he made the exactly self-similar ansatz, computed a solution, and also computed a solution by doing this interpolating family trick, and found that the solution that he got from solving the ODEs from self-similar ansatz matched very well the dynamical evolution. So these frames show successive instants in a specific self-similar evolution of the perfect fluid. And they also looked at mass scaling. And once again, found a scaling law with the exponent very close to the values that had been seen for perfect fluid and gravitational wave collapse. Sorry, for scalar field and gravitational wave collapse. It's now known that there isn't true universality, and we're not exactly sure why this approximate concordance of the 3 critical exponents for those 3 models comes about.
How
because we have models that exhibit a wide range of scaling exponents. And perfect fluid is a good example. As you vary the polytropic equation of state, you can get a scaling law basically from gamma goes from close to zero to gamma goes close to one continuously. And the same thing for multi-scalar field models. Okay, so I just want to spend a few minutes now discussing how we understand some of these results in terms of self-similar spacetimes and perturbation theory. So the idea is I adopt coordinates that are adapted to the self-similarity. So I have a coordinate zeta, which I just take to be r over t, where this r is going to be my aerial radius as usual. And this t is going to be proper time measured from this accumulation point, from the singularity. I'll measure it backwards. And then the idea is that things don't change as you propagate along the similarity fan. Things only change as you cut across it. So if I go into logarithmic coordinates then, and I send the origin off to infinity that way, and then I have the following view, the two types of self-similarity. On the one hand, I have a continuous self-similar solution where I'm just going to have some feature that propagates to the left with some pattern speed. The more interesting, complicated discrete self-similarity looks like this schematically. I have non-trivial evolution. So there's some non-trivial evolution as I go along this fan, but every delta, I recover the same profile. Okay, so on the one hand, for the continuously self-similar solution, I have g of zeta and tau is g of zeta and tau prime, where tau and tau prime are arbitrary. For the DSS, discretely self-similar case, I have g of zeta tau is g of zeta tau plus or minus n delta, where that delta is a model-dependent but initial data-independent echoing exponent. So Chuck Evans recognized early on that you should be able to do perturbation theory about these solutions, and that could give you a handle on the mass scaling. It was Koike Hara and Asar Adahi who really carried this program through, and then Maison, and a lot of work done here with Thug and his student Eric Hirschman and Carsten Goodenlach. So the idea is, for a given matter model, which means matter content, couplings, symmetry, we're going to find one or more of these isolated in parameter space, critical solutions. And generally, we can either find those via dynamic evolution of these interpolating families or by direct construction from a particular handset, which reflects what you know about the critical solution, usually through these full-blown solutions of the PDEs. So you then consider perturbation theory using G star as the background. In general, you're going to find eigenmodes, Fi, with associated eigenvalues, lambda I. And then as P goes to the critical value, we can write the departure of delta G as a function of the coordinates, my similarity coordinate zeta. And just for convenience, I choose the logarithmic radial coordinate rho. I could equally have well chosen tau. As a function of the parameter P is, by definition, just G minus G star. And that can be written as an infinite sum. These coefficients, Ci, which are going to depend on the parameter, sometimes these growth functions with lambda I rho, lambda I being the eigenvalue, times the mode functions. So for those of you familiar with statistical mechanical critical phenomena, this should all be very familiar. What Koike and his collaborators pointed out was that the observed critical behavior really strongly suggests that there's only one unstable or one relevant mode in these solutions. So the ansatz then is that there's only one mode that has a real part, which is greater than zero, and then all other modes damp as P goes to P star. So the general picture then, schematically, is the saddle point where we have a single unstable mode. The evolution, the critical evolution by tuning, you get tuned to this central location. But then depending on the sign of the unstable mode, which is controlled by your choice of P minus P star, you either get pushed to black hole formation or to dispersal.
The nature of the eigenfunction depends on the choice of the family.
Yes. No. No. No, the eigenfunction is independent of the initial data family. The only thing that depends on the family are the coefficients.
The eigenvalues.
Yes.
But people have not considered non-spherical perturbation.
Yes, they have.
They have.
Yep.
And is that stable?
Yes.
Comes back to spherical.
Yes.
So spherical symmetry is stable.
Yes, as far as is known for almost all the for the models that have been studied, which are perfect fluid models, and the scalar field models, it appears that there are no other growing modes.
I see. That seems like an important point. If
yes.
People understand why spherical.
No, but intuitively, you can always play this tuning game where you can tune across the black hole threshold. So you're going to have some kind of a solution at the black hole threshold. And if it's not spherically symmetric, then it's going to be even more interesting. Right? But there's nothing that stops you from playing this tuning game in with arbitrary data.
I was a bit surprised when the first results came out showing that the spherical solution isn't going to be stable. You know, it's a dynamic question. There isn't going to be a simple, elegant argument showing you why it could have been. I don't think it's a sort of pattern choice. Kind of thing. The dynamic system is making a choice.
What do you mean pattern choice?
Well, you know, like an open-head metaphysics sort of choosing whether to go into roles, say, improve the camp, choosing to go into roles of convention or some of the patterns or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a dynamic thing that's happening to choose that.
Well, I think it could probably be understood, though, also in the context of the uniqueness theorems of the known end states, a collapse. The fact that we know that Schwarzschild is stable with respect to small perturbations and the Kerr is stable to perturbations. So if there are additional threshold solutions, they're not going to be long-lived.
Oh, yes, that's absolutely true. But it's still a known result. It's a new result. It doesn't just follow from a known result.
No. Absolutely
well,
not.
But we also know that there's a non-spherical symmetric.
But there's
the vacuum state.
Yes, that's right.
So the critical thing is the vacuum state can't be spherically symmetric.
That's right.
Something and we don't know what it is.
Right.
Is that a rotating solution?
No.
They hope it's a case without rotation, but presumably there might be a rotating solution.
Yeah.
Knowing that the vacuum state wasn't
rotating. No, we're trying to get a code together to do that, but it's going to take a while. In any case, if we make this assumption then that there's only a single growing mode, and if I just, for convenience, say that that real part of lambda 1 is just lambda 1, then as p goes to p star, I only have to deal with the first term in the expansion, and then as long as p is smooth at the transition point, and this is the place where, if you think about the phenomenology, the only way you can construct a non-smooth family of data is essentially to put in some number to an infinite precision. If you choose any generic initial data, you're going to have a smooth transition as p goes to the critical point. So the expansion then tells you that you're going to have essentially the derivative of c1 with respect to p at p star times p minus p star times e to the lambda 1 rho. And it's this combination here which determines at which point you're no longer in the linear regime and at which point you're going to form a black hole. So the condition for either peel off for the field to escape to infinity or for a black hole to form is that this factor is a constant. And from this, from that fact, the scaling law falls almost immediately. What you're doing by tuning P minus P star is just tuning down the effect of that fundamental mode, that unstable mode. So the condition then for black hole formation is P minus P star e to lambda 1 rho as a function of p is equal to some constant, and that black hole will form on that scale wherever that peel off or that collapse starts forming. And so you immediately get to the log of the mass of the black hole. Well, the log of the mass of the black hole then is going to go like rho plus some constant, and then e of log p minus p star e to lambda 1 is some constant, and the mass scaling law falls immediately, with gamma being given by 1 over the real part of the Lyapunov exponent, or the Lyapunov inverse Lyapunov exponent, if you will. So it's now known to get this picture of the critical solutions then as the so-called intermediate attractors in Berenbaat's language. So you have one-dimensional unstable manifolds. If you will, these solutions are minimally unstable. They're unstable, but they're sort of the least unstable solutions you can construct. And this also explains all the observed criticality, all the observed universality of the critical phenomena, because there really is only one critical solution. And all you're doing by tuning in with your particular choice of family is, you know, changing the coefficients that appear in front of that perturbative expansion.
And so this picture has been validated now for essentially all the spherically symmetric models where we have good data, and that includes the perfect fluid, and that gave us a very good indication that the gamma, the scaling exponent, was a strong function of the equation of state for an axion dilaton model, work that was done here.
And Jim Horn,
well,
have you tried just a complex?
Yeah, the complex scalar field has the mass of scalar field. The single scalar field is a limit. You can also get charge black holes there, and the charge has an independent scaling law. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of scalar electrodynamics is described down here as an additional scaling law for the charge.
What about a kinetic model, the Vlasov equation?
The Vlasov equation, there's some results which seem to show that there's a mass gap. I'm slightly suspicious of those results, but it may be that there is generically a mass gap, which would then probably depend on the details of the initial data.
If people have tried changing the matter, have people tried changing the equation of gravity by adding some
I think some people have looked at it in the context of Moffat's theory, mm-hmm. but not to any great depth.
In what respect are you suspicious about the kinetic itself? Because the kinetic model had the best mathematical...
Because the numerical analysis, I mean, the published results had some features in them that looked slightly reminiscent of the things that we used to see before we knew about the mass gap, the lack of a mass gap in massless scalar collapse, for example.
So which are the numerical results you're referring to?
Alan Rendall and collaborators. But, right. That's essentially the only results I know of. I'm not saying that they're wrong, I'm just slightly suspicious of them. Yeah, but the Brown-Dickey theory is equivalent to a multi-scalar model. It's essentially a limit of the, or it's a sector of the nonlinear sigma model. So there you're essentially changing the couplings of the scalar field. You're not really changing too much the details of gravity. However, there's a simple model of the dilaton gravity, and you get the same kind of behavior. And I think it goes back to this point that as long as you have this competition where you have these two distinct end states, you're going to see these distinct states. Well, I don't have time to discuss the Yang-Mills collapse in any detail. I'll just point out that in this case, this SU2 Yang-Mills collapse is another model that's been studied in some detail. You see both kinds of behavior here. You see the echoing, so this is a typical late-time profile of all the echoes that you get in SU2 collapse of a Yang-Mills field. You can think of it in some ways as just it's a single component Yang-Mills field, so I think of it as a weird kind of, with some purely magnetic ansatz. And one of the things that's been known for a long time in that context, a purely magnetic spherically symmetric SU2 model, that there are these static solutions, the Bartnik-McKinnon solutions. This Yang-Mills potential has to be interpolated between 1 and minus 1. Those are specific vacuum states in this model. And so you can get these kink solutions where you've effectively balanced off the Yang-Mills and the gravitational forces. It's been known for a long time that these are unstable, but the lowest lying mode here, the n equals 1 mode, n counts the number of zero crossings, is a critical solution in the sense that you can find it by an interpolating family. And here's just an evolution which shows that fact. In dotted line is the static solution. The solid line is the evolution, time evolution. The Yang-Mills field implodes. It snaps onto the n equals 1 solution, sheds off the energy. It doesn't need to be that n equals 1 solution. Hangs in there for a proper time, which is now proportional to the Oppenheim exponent for the time decay of the unstable solution, and then eventually peels off to infinity. That's a slightly subcritical solution. If you made that calculation supercritical, the black hole would form, but essentially all the matter in the configuration would be trapped in the black hole, and you get a gap, a black hole threshold. And similar behavior has now been seen in the massive scalar field as well.
But the Yang-Mills field never form a lump of its own, right? It's a nonlinear equation, so the Yang-Mills field.
That's right. By itself, you can't get these static solutions. Right. Mm-hmm. So the same sort of behavior.
The origin of the gap is the formation of the solid.
at that time dependent, time independent solution.
That's the gap is the mass of the
right. Yeah, the mass of the Yang-Mills field, the gravitating mass, is essentially its mass gap. To as far as good accuracy as you can ascertain.
So presumably, if you were to take a galactic scale, so
well, again, it depends on the nature of the initial data, because the massless scalar field, the scalar field, the critical solution is sort of, there's a natural scaling limit.
It doesn't have to be a massive scalar field.
But again, there's a natural scaling limit that if you give the field enough initial momenta, it gets into the massless configuration. Because if you will, that as you develop these echoes, the scalar field itself remains bounded, so the potential terms remain bounded, but the kinetic energy gets driven to infinity. So it's a natural massless limit. You start with initial data that has...
You really need a scale invariant theory, which I thought of.
To do what?
To get this gap, first order.
No, you just have to, you can vary the initial data. I'm saying it's going to depend on the initial data. So Patrick and some collaborators, Patrick Brady and some collaborators, have shown that for the massive scalar field, you can get the massive scalar field, you can get both types of behavior, the type 1 and the type 2.
And how do you get the type
2? The type 1, you just get static solutions. Static solutions, you can collapse blobs of scalar field, massive scalar field, and they'll sit around and be stars, or they'll collapse and form black holes. Oh, and they have a threshold that... Right, you have some effective pressure from the mass, but you also have a rest frame, so the scalar field can sit there. Okay. Well, people have already asked about the angular momentum, and as far as we know, the solutions that have been studied so far are stable to at least small perturbations from spherical symmetry. There's a lot of interest.
In fact, this charged black hole, right, in one set of models.
Yes.
And you said there are different critical exponents.
There's another scaling law, okay?
Yeah, what does it mean? It's still one tunable parameter.
There's one tunable parameter. If you tune that parameter, you find an additional exponent, which is essentially related to the first exponent.
Essentially, what does Q over M do?
It goes to zero. Because, right, there's no further unstable modes. Okay, so the charge dissipates.
I see, but these are two different exponents.
Yes, but they're related to one another. So there's a lot of interesting questions when it comes to ask what effect does quantum mechanics have on the picture. And all I can say, and I've been saying this for many years, the picture is very murky. We've got sort of mixed results. On the one hand, is...
Sorry, what do you mean by quantum mechanics?
Well, these are all done in semi-classical approximations.
Matter is
treated quantum mechanically. So... the heuristic arguments, you can come up with a few of them, but on one hand, you've got fact quantization introduces a length scale, so you might expect to see a mass gap at threshold, and there's some evidence for that. On the other hand, you might think that the predominant effect of Hawking radiation would be to renormalize the competition, essentially because you could view it as another way that the energy wants to leak out, and then you might expect that the scaling would persist with a semi-classical approximation was valid, and there's some evidence to support that view, and then there's some mixed evidence, some more recent work done by Brady, Ottawa, where the semi-classical corrections will result in a mass gap if you assume there's a continuously self-similar solution and the scaling exponent is greater than a half. They can't really say what happens if the scaling exponent is less than one half. But the key point is that every one of these type 2 critical solutions is a strong field on arbitrarily small scales. So in a very real sense, I think that these solutions really demand to be quantized because they naturally propagate strong curvature down to the Planck limit. In a way that if you just started with a Schwarzschild black hole, you have to tune by hand.
Quantum field theory, you'd expect to break down.
That's right.
Except maybe that's about 50.
Yep, but there's still some, I claim there's some interesting physics to be learned by looking there.
Given that perturbation theory might not become so good in that gravity-bearing field, what methods are used?
I think methods have to be invented.
No, but you've made some statements about what people think.
Oh, they do. They do perturbation theory, but they try to keep the approximation self-consistent.
Is that possible?
Well, Patrick can address that. As
oh, they are.
All right, I'll just throw up my planned work slide. I mean, clearly, from my point of view, the most pressing question from the point of view of classical collapse is what happens when we relax the spherical symmetry restriction. We'll be able to look at new matter fields, including electromagnetic field, and crucially redo the gravitational wave collapse. And eventually, we really want to do this in full three dimensions, three spatial dimensions. There's some interesting effects you get when you put in multiple fields. You get relative stability of the various critical solutions. So, for example, the Yang-Mills solution seems to be, the Eckling solution seems to be extremely unstable to the addition of, for example, a scalar field. So you put in an arbitrarily small amount of the scalar field, and it will get pumped up to its critical solution in the presence of the Yang-Mills critical solution. Quantum effects is a big unknown. Be interesting to understand where the discrete self-similarity is coming from. I think there's a lot of work to be done on the understanding in more detail the global structure of the critical space-times, although Doug and Eric Hirschman in particular have done a pretty nice job of that in the context of the continuously self-similar space-times. And then, of course, there's the question of whether or not this is relevant at all to any possible astrophysical collapse. Anyway, thank you for your time.